Welcome to the August 1990 edition of The Freeman on Tape. The Freeman on Tape is the audio edition of The Freeman, published by the Foundation for Economic Education, 30 South Broadway, Irvington on Hudson, New York, 10533. The August 1990 edition of The Freeman on Tape includes on side one, The Last Wild Children of Capitalism by William B. Irvine. Misdirected Compassion by Douglas Matakonis. The Social Security Trust Fund, Savings versus Saving by Richard W. Fulmer. A Tale of Two Estates by Andrew E. Barniscus. And on side two, The Growth of Government in the United States by Robert Higgs. And a fee classic, The Basis of Liberty by Dean Russell. Last Wild Children of Capitalism by William B. Irvine. Dr. Irvine is Associate Professor of Philosophy at Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio. American futures markets have long played the role of villain in popular economic thinking. In his 1903 novel, The Pit, for example, Frank Norris offers his readers a description of the opening of trading on the Chicago Board of Trade. Instantly, a tumult was unchained. Arms were flung upward in strenuous gestures, and from above the crowding heads in the wheat pit, a multitude of hands, eager, the fingers extended, leapt into the air. All articulate expression was lost in the single explosion of sound as the traders surged downwards to the center of the pit, grabbing each other, struggling towards each other, tramping, stomping, charging through with might and main. It was probably Norris, as much as any author, who was responsible for creating the image of futures market as madhouse. This novelistic image of futures trading has not only survived the passage of time, but has been enhanced by the advent of television. Broadcasts from commodities exchanges demonstrate that Norris did not exaggerate. Futures exchanges are wild, some would say surrealistic places. All these images have had an impact. Ask most Americans what futures traders do, and they'll tell you that futures traders are adult men and women who make vast fortunes by standing in a circle, gesticulating wildly, and shouting at each other. In the minds of many Americans, futures traders resemble frenzied gamblers on a casino floor, or participants in a contact sport whose rules are particularly demented. Should such people, many Americans wonder, be allowed to play a role in the shaping of the American economy? Indeed, should such people be allowed to roam the streets freely? Even among those who are not swayed by this image of futures traders, there has been considerable antipathy towards futures markets. This antipathy is founded on the belief, common among many intellectuals, that futures markets play no significant economic role and have no socially redeeming value. Instead, they exist simply so that greedy people can make fortunes at the expense of farmers, small investors, consumers, and other little people. In the last few years, the traditional distrust of futures markets has grown apace as the result of two events. The first was the 1987 stock market crash. Many investors, regulators, and theoreticians pointed an accusing finger at stock index futures as being partially responsible for the crash. The second event was the criminal investigation still underway into trading abuses on the floors of various futures exchanges, abuses that allegedly included cheating customers, market manipulation, fraud, and tax evasion. As the result of this double blow, the future of American futures is in doubt. There are a number of people calling for regulation. Shouldn't the government do something about futures exchanges, they ask, particularly if the members of these exchanges are corrupt, or if their trading activities can cause stock market crashes? Should we then do something about American futures markets? Would greater government regulation be advisable? Indeed, should futures trading be banned altogether? In what follows, I would like to defend futures markets as an economic institution and inquire into the proper role that the government should play with respect to these markets. There is, I think, a role for the government in futures markets, but I think this role stops far short of the kind of heavy-handed regulation that many have called for. Before I begin my defense of futures markets, a few words of explanation are in order. To begin with, a futures contract, as its name implies, is a contract between individuals. Whereas many contracts, for example, a bill of sale for a car, specify an immediate exchange of goods, a futures contract specifies an exchange of goods at some future date. Although individuals can draw up custom-made futures contracts between themselves, there are advantages to using the standardized contracts traded on futures exchanges like the Chicago Board of Trade or the COMEX in New York. For one thing, at organized exchanges, it is much easier to find someone with whom to enter into a contract. And if one later decides to back out of the contract, it is much easier to find someone willing to assume the contract in question. By buying a futures contract, one becomes obligated to take delivery of a certain amount of a certain commodity for a certain price on a certain date. The commodity in question can be something mundane like orange juice or pork bellies, from which bacon is made, or it can be something exotic like palladium or something intangible like a basket of common stocks. In parallel fashion, by selling a futures contract, one becomes obligated to deliver a certain amount of a certain commodity for a certain price on a certain date. Who would buy and sell such contracts? And what would motivate them to do so? Many Americans think that the only people who would buy or sell futures contracts are speculators, and that the motive of these speculators is greed. In fact, speculators are only one of the groups who participate in futures transactions. The other major group consists of the producers and consumers of various commodities, that is, businessmen, farmers, and other sober-minded types. A farmer might, for example, want in July to lock in the price of the wheat he will harvest in September. Selling a futures contract enables him to do so. Conversely, a baker might want in July to lock in the price of the wheat he will need in September. Buying a futures contract, say from the farmer just mentioned, can give him the price guarantee he seeks. Thus, when the farmer sells a futures contract to the baker, the transaction serves the interests of both, and both would be worse off if they were prohibited from entering into the contract in question. Futures contracts, then, can be seen as a form of insurance. But instead of insuring people against loss of or damage to a physical asset like a house or a car or a crop of wheat, futures contracts insure producers and consumers of a certain commodity against price changes in the commodity in question. In other words, futures contracts function to shift the risk of price changes from the producers and consumers of a commodity to speculators, who are willing to assume the risk in question in return for the chance to profit from doing so. It should thus be clear that by buying and selling futures contracts, people are engaging in one of their most basic economic rights, the right to enter into contracts with other individuals. This in turn means that when the government curbs the activities of futures exchanges, the government is to some extent infringing on the right of Americans to enter into contracts with others. Furthermore, the right in question is not an abstract right, but a right the violation of which can do real harm to real people. For notice that in a free society, people enter into a contract only if they judge that it is in their best interests to do so. When the government steps in and prevents people from entering into contracts, or places restrictions on the contracts they can enter into, it is blocking them from doing what they take to be in their own best interests. It is true that the parties to a contract may be mistaken about what is in their best interests. However, a case can be made that people generally have a far better idea of what is in their own interests than politicians do. What if people don't like the contracts or trading rules offered by a futures exchange? What if they think the rules or contracts are unfair? Then they won't trade on the exchange in question. They will instead trade on other exchanges whose rules or contracts they like better, or they won't trade at all. Does this mean that the government should have no role at all in the operation of futures markets? By no means. Most people agree that one proper role of government is to act as the enforcer of contracts into which individuals have entered. If you make a contract with someone and he fails to live up to his end of the deal, you can seek compensation in a court of law. Thus, if a futures exchange does not live up to its own rules and fails to compensate those who are thereby harmed, the courts should enter the picture. In summary, leave it to the futures exchanges to design standardized contracts and to set trading rules. Leave it to the government to take action when futures exchanges fail to enforce the rules they have set. Futures exchanges help far more people than they harm, and those they harm, more often than not, are speculators who knowingly and willingly expose themselves to the risk of harm in return for a chance at profit. Futures exchanges present a tempting target for government regulators. Even in the best of times, the public distrusts futures exchanges, and recent controversies surrounding these exchanges have made their political position weaker than ever. One can only hope that futures exchanges will retain their independence in coming years. We will all be poorer should regulators succeed in taming these last wild children of capitalism. Misdirected Compassion by Douglas Matakonis. Mr. Matakonis recently graduated from Rutgers University. He will be attending George Mason University School of Law in the fall. Nearly every day, we are confronted with newspaper and television stories about society's less fortunate members, families living in squalid conditions, and homeless people sleeping on the streets of America's greatest cities. Understandably, these stories are shocking to most of us. No one in a country such as ours, we say to ourselves, should be reduced to living in conditions like these. Someone should do something about it. Unfortunately, this urge to help the poor typically leads people to believe that only government-sponsored programs can provide the needed aid. Whether the proposed remedy is a government-mandated living wage, rent control laws to ensure affordable housing, or other interventionist policies, the underlying premise is that compassion for the poor demands that we increase the size and scope of government. When we look at the results of these policies, however, we see that government intervention doesn't improve the lot of the poor. In fact, it often worsens the situation. Supporters of the minimum wage, for example, assert that the poor should be helped by ensuring that their jobs pay a wage that meets their basic needs. That sounds reasonable and compassionate. However, what if a worker's productive output is less than the minimum wage? In this case, the very people who are supposed to be helped by the minimum wage, the low-skilled working poor, are hurt the most, since employers are less likely to hire them at this new higher wage. As a result, a law that was passed out of compassion for the needy produces higher unemployment and more deprivation. The results are similar with rent controls. In this case, a law is passed to make housing more affordable for those with low incomes. Again, this sounds reasonable and compassionate. The actual result of such a law, however, is to reduce the supply of affordable housing. By setting a ceiling above which rents cannot rise, such laws prevent landlords from earning returns comparable to other investments, such as stocks or bonds, that require less time and fixed capital. Thus, investors are discouraged from building new low-income housing or maintaining properties they already own. Once again, a law that was passed out of a sense of compassion for the poor does the greatest harm to precisely those it is supposed to help. One is led to ask, if we really care about the less fortunate members of society, why do we pass laws and implement policies that make them worse off than they were before? It would be far better, practically and morally, to abandon this blind faith in the state's ability to help the poor and search for a better way to assist those in need. There is nothing wrong with feeling compassion for the poor. Human charity, so long as it isn't coerced, is admirable. Problems develop, however, when compassion is misdirected into policies that actually worsen the plight of the poor. If this compassion is genuine, then those who feel it must abandon these policies and recognize that the best remedy for poverty lies not in a larger and more powerful government bureaucracy, but in an expansion of the free market and the opportunities it provides for everyone. The Social Security Trust Fund, Savings versus Saving, by Richard W. Fulmer. Mr. Fulmer is a systems specialist in Houston. For every person receiving Social Security benefits in 1950, 17 other Americans were employed. By 1970, the ratio had dropped to 3 workers per beneficiary. And as post-war baby boomers reach retirement age early in the 21st century, that ratio will drop to 2-to-1. In the year 2030, workers will be paying an estimated 1/3 of their wages to support Social Security recipients. Originally, the program was intended to be pay-as-you-go, with receipts equaling disbursements. With insolvency looming, however, Congress in 1977 and 1983 decided to increase tax revenues beyond current expenditures and save the difference for future needs through the purchase of government securities. In practice, however, the purchase money is spent on current programs, and the trust fund is left with IOUs. Thus, Social Security tax receipts aren't saved in any meaningful sense. Proponents of the trust fund scheme argue that the government is simply investing in treasury notes, in the same way that a private citizen might, and, like the citizen, can expect a return on the principal when the notes are redeemed. But how is this return to be generated? The money isn't being used to produce wealth, but rather is spent on current consumption. Investors must bank on the government's future ability to sell more notes, that is, to keep the pyramid growing, or failing that, to collect more taxes. If taxes are used to buy back the IOUs, then we are left with the original problem. Workers are still footing the bill. Saving must be more than the mere husbandry of paper dollars. Ultimately, there must be something for those dollars to purchase. Production must precede consumption. True saving is an increase in real wealth, not dollars. As Adam Smith pointed out, increased wealth can result only from greater production, which in turn can be achieved only by raising the number of productive laborers or by improving the efficiency of laborers already employed. This cannot occur without additional capital investment. Capital is required for the maintenance of new workers or for the development of better methods or machinery. An increase in the nation's productivity leads to a larger tax base from which tax revenues may be drawn. Therefore, the best long-term investment any government can make is to allow the private sector to retain its capital so that production can grow. If instead the government takes more money from the market than it currently needs so as to form a savings fund, it erodes its own tax base. In the end, the creation of such a fund reduces future tax income, and wealth isn't saved, but lost. How can we remedy the current situation? First, we must admit that there are no funds in the trust fund. The money has been commingled with other federal revenues and spent. The federal government runs multi-billion dollar deficits, which include Social Security receipts and disbursements, so it can't have net savings. Social Security hasn't been made solvent. It remains the same bankrupt pyramid scheme it has been all along. The problem has only been compounded by creating yet another pyramid scheme with which to finance the first. Next, we have to identify our real goal. It is not to salvage a particular program, nor is it to pile up mountains of paper money. The goal is to create sufficient real wealth to support people in their old age. Stated this way, it becomes clear that the issue is one of increasing production. This can best be done by ending Social Security and allowing people to provide for their own retirements by investing their own money in real productive capital through private banks, pension plans, and corporate stocks and bonds. Only through such private investment can we provide the capital to expand our industrial base. Only through real saving, producing more than we consume, can we provide for the future. We cannot do it by amassing paper dollars and treasury notes. A Tale of Two Estates by Andrew E. Barniscus. Andrew E. Barniscus is an aerospace engineer and consultant in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. This is a tale of two estates in Bucks County in eastern Pennsylvania. Actually, it's a story about a single piece of real estate, but one that's had two identities during my life. In the early 1950s, when I was a boy, it was a millionaire's estate. It was private property, trespassing strictly forbidden. But a creek ran through the property. Much of its several square miles was covered by woods, and it held an irresistible lure for boys. Looking back, I realized that the fishing in the section of creek that ran through the property was probably no better than in the sections outside its borders, but sneaking quietly through the pine-covered hills to fish in one of the forbidden pools was an adventure that magnified perceptions of both the size and the number of fish. The estate was patrolled by caretakers, and we all knew stories of terrible things that had befallen boys caught trespassing. But it never seemed to have happened to anyone we knew personally. The stories were always about some kid a couple of towns over who went to a different school. The only time I came close to getting caught was when I went with a buddy who started being loud and began breaking down small trees. After that, I always went alone and never came close to being spotted again. One day, after I had made an early morning foray into the estate, I was returning home along one of the dirt roads through the woods when I heard a horse-drawn vehicle approaching. That was unusual because by the early 1950s, all of the local farmers used tractors, and the few horses still around were kept for riding. As I hid in the bushes, I saw a strange sight. An elegant carriage filled with young men and women dressed in 19th-century costumes, laughing and joking as four beautiful black horses pulled them along. To this day, I don't know the reason for their summer morning costume ride, but I remember the thoughts it brought to me then and over the years. How wonderful the world could be that some people could indulge in elegant play in the middle of a weekday. While my own father worked at exhausting labor and neighboring farmers cursed their rusting machinery, here were grown people who could play midday make-believe with accoutrements that probably cost more than what most of my father's acquaintances would make in a year. I may not have cared much for fancy horses or even for well-dressed young ladies at the time, but that vision of what was attainable in life influenced me greatly over the years. Sometime between my boyhood and my early adult years, the estate acquired a new identity. The millionaire owner died and willed the property to the state. Eventually, it was turned into a state park. From being the property and plaything of a few rich individuals, it became the property of everyone, at least in theory. Nevertheless, its former identity would once more pique my imagination. After working for several years following high school, serving in the Army, and saving my money, I started working my way through a local college as a laboratory assistant. One day I was in the laboratory with a professor when the conversation turned to the old estate. Coincidentally, a maintenance man who was working with us had been a caretaker on the estate in his younger days. He didn't need much prompting to begin pouring out stories of the extravagant, eccentric lifestyle of his former employers, the lavish parties, the dozens of servants, the grand cars, the small fortune spent on the whims of a moment. My professor, a true English gentleman and a sincere and outspoken socialist, was horrified and quite literally shaken. "How terrible that anyone should have so much," he finally managed to stammer. As his student, I nodded false agreement while thinking, "No, how wonderful." I was one of the professor's better students. I wondered what he thought kept me at my studies until well past midnight. Dreams of working on rusting tractors or of moving crates in a warehouse? Certainly not. I'd done those things. It was a vision I had seen that life could be much better than most of what had surrounded me while growing up. If I hadn't thought that something much, much better was attainable, I would have been out with my friends instead of studying. I sought out the maintenance man several times and extracted as many of his stories of the old estate as I could. Often, one of those tales would spur me to continue working an extra hour or two after everyone else had turned off their lights. Along the way, I had decided that having so much, whether it was wealth or academic success, had to start with work. Years later, the estate, now in its new public identity, was to provide me with one more vision. I took my young son to the park to see if the old secret pools still produced fish. We didn't have any luck because some noisy kids were throwing rocks down from the cliffs. Also, many of the old natural landmarks had been vandalized, so I couldn't find the best pools. When we got back to the parking lot, a motorcycle gang was drag racing, openly smoking dope and smashing beer bottles while a powerless park guard looked the other way. As one by one, intimidated young families packed their picnics to leave, I looked at the tableau before me, the scruffy motorcyclists charging wildly around the lot, framed against the elegant old mansion, still standing on the overlooking hill, and thought, "This is the triumph of the Marxist vision. The proletariat has inherited the capitalist's estate." I suppose that you could count the number of people who visit the park each year, and argue that more people get more good out of the estate now than when the millionaire owned it. Of course, there are annual lawsuits by those seeking to prevent the hunts the state holds to control the deer herd, and there probably will be a lawsuit filed by some bicyclists who have just been told they can't use the woodland roads because they interfere with the horseback riders. There always seems to be some sort of political contest going on over how the park will be used, and while the state makes a genuine effort, it's pretty hard to gather up all the trash that people can spread over several square miles. The Fish Commission gave up stocking the creek several years ago. I've known the estate in its two identities, and I know what its old identity taught me. But my son has seen it only in its public identity, I wonder what it has taught him. Possibly that in the world of collective ownership, things owned by everyone are cared for by no one, and that control then belongs to those with the power or arrogance or brutality to take it. I know that I can tell my son about values and virtues and the work ethic, but there are no words that will have the impact of the vision he saw at the park that day. End of side one. Please forward to the end and turn the cassette over. The Growth of Government in the United States by Robert Higgs. Robert Higgs is the Thomas F. Gleed Professor of Business Administration in the Albers School of Business, Seattle University, and the author of Crisis and Leviathan, Critical Episodes in the Growth of American Government, Oxford University Press, 1987. He presented these observations as the Fat Hour Lecture at the University of Arizona on April 2nd, 1990. The following is an excerpt from that lecture. We heard a lot about big government when Ronald Reagan was first seeking the presidency. Lately, the topic has attracted less attention from politicians, commentators, and scholars, but big government itself has not disappeared. Over the past decade, as over the past century, American government has continued to grow. Our nation was founded by men who believed in limited government, especially limited central government. They were not anarchists, nor did they espouse laissez-faire, but they did believe that rulers ought to be restrained and accountable to the people they govern. If the founders could see what has happened to the relation between the citizens and the government in the United States during the past two centuries, they would be appalled. The size and scope of government are important for many reasons. By virtue of their taxing, spending, and regulating, governments affect the allocation of economic resources, the distribution of wealth, and the rate of economic growth. Governments determine the very nature of our political economy, the character of the social organization within which we may lawfully conduct our affairs and pursue our goals. The size and scope of government determine, they are, so to speak, the opposite side of, our freedoms. All but the few anarchists among us recognize that effective liberty requires some government, if only to define and protect rights to life and property. Beyond a point, however, bigger government begins to cut into our liberties. Then the growth of government becomes synonymous with the sacrifice of liberty. In the United States, we entered this stage a long time ago. When we say that government has grown, what do we mean? Government is not a single thing, measurable along a scale like inches of height or pounds of weight. The size of government can change in different dimensions, many of them incommensurable. One dimension of government is the burden of taxation. In the early years of the 20th century, federal, state, and local governments took in revenues equal to 6 to 7% of the gross national product, GNP. By 1950, revenues had risen to 24% of GNP. Over the past 40 years, the tax proportion has drifted irregularly upward and now stands at about 32% of GNP. Another dimension of government, and an even more appropriate index of its fiscal burden than tax revenues, is government spending. In the early years of the 20th century, federal, state, and local governments spent an amount equal to 6 to 7% of the gross national product. By 1950, government outlays, net of intergovernmental grants, had risen to 21% of GNP. Over the past 40 years, the spending proportion has drifted irregularly upward and now stands at about 34% of GNP. Still another index of the size of government is government employment. Early in the 20th century, federal, state, and local governments employed about 4% of the civilian labor force. By 1950, government employment had risen to about 10%. During the past 40 years, government employment rose and fell. It reached a peak in the mid-1970s at nearly 16%, then fell to its present level of roughly 14%. That is, one worker in every seven. This figure doesn't include the 2 million members of the armed forces. Although the employment ratio seems at first glance to indicate a recent decline in the government size, one should not jump to that conclusion. Many people who are classified as members of the private labor force actually work for governments as contractors or employees or subcontractors of contractors. Between 1980 and 1987, for example, about 1 million additional workers found jobs in the defense industries, virtually all of them, obviously, working on projects set in motion and financed by the government. Similar changes have occurred elsewhere, as governments have privatized more functions by contracting out the performance of tasks previously performed by workers on the regular government payroll. It would be a mistake to suppose that government has shrunk just because regular government employment hasn't kept pace with the growth of the labor force. Indexes of government taxing, spending, and employing tell us something about the growth of government, but what they tell us is far from the whole story. Even if government had grown in none of these dimensions, it might have become a bigger factor in determining the allocation of economic resources, the distribution of wealth, and the rate of economic growth. It could have done so, and in fact, it has done so, by means of increased regulation. I refer to regulation in its broadest sense, including the legal requirements expressed in statutes, executive orders, and judicial decisions, as well as the directives of regulatory agencies such as the Environmental Protection Agency and the Securities and Exchange Commission. The shelves are sagging under the growing weight of such authoritative commands. Just skim through the Federal Register sometime if you are willing to risk becoming deeply depressed, or, for an even more profoundly depressing experience, attempt to read any recent regulatory statute, say a consumer protection law. Tax laws also are de facto regulatory statutes, and perhaps the most incomprehensible of all legislation. In regulation, we come face to face with the visible hand of government at work, imposing largely hidden costs. The costs are hidden in part because they are borne by private parties in the process of compliance. Meeting prescribed standards, avoiding prohibited actions, and so forth, and spread across the consuming public in the form of higher prices for goods and services. Americans, despite much habitual grumbling, are proud of their economy, which continues to rank among the world's most productive. What we have done, we can see and appreciate. But what we might have done, the miracles we might have wrought had we been free to do so, we shall never know. In this sense, the costs of an ever more regulated economy are truly incalculable. So government is still big, and government is still growing in the United States. Why? To answer this question, we need to understand some history. To start with, we need to find out whether American government was ever really small, and if it was, what made it get bigger? You may recall from your school history text that the United States government in the mid and late 19th century adhered to the doctrine of laissez-faire, the doctrine of hands-off. Well, that lesson conceals more than it reveals. In fact, in important respects, the label of laissez-faire shouldn't be applied at all. At no time did the United States fully achieve the condition denoted by the term laissez-faire. From about the 1840s to the 1890s, however, the United States approximated, perhaps as closely as any large society ever did, a condition we might call the minimal state. Most important, governments established the legal framework of property rights within which the price system could operate to allocate resources. As economic conditions changed, governments molded the law to new conditions and allowed economic growth to continue relatively unimpeded by obsolete legal restraints. Obviously, somewhere along the line, the dominant ideology of the United States has undergone a complete revolution. I exaggerate only a little if I say that now most Americans believe that governments may legitimately give to people or take away from them virtually anything, anytime, any place, checked only by the license conveyed by government officials having been elected in the constitutionally sanctioned manner. Where once Americans viewed the powers of government as properly limited, and the rights of individuals as primary and natural, Americans now view the powers of government as properly unlimited, and the rights of individuals as subordinate to the pursuit of any declared public policy. How did so many activities once viewed as not the proper business of government come to be undertaken by governments and accepted as legitimate? I have no short, definitive answer. The process by which the dominant ideology of the American people changed over the past century is surely complex, and no one understands it fully. It is possible, however, to identify certain critical aspects of the process. With the economic transformation of the United States in the late 19th century, a process that witnessed rapid urbanization and the growth of big business, as well as many other striking developments, collectivist views began to gain adherence here, as they did throughout the Western world. The ideological shift became quite striking during the Progressive Era at the beginning of the 20th century. It was not unconnected with such consequential institutional changes as the Income Tax Amendment to the Constitution and the creation of the Federal Reserve System. So clearly a tendency existed, rooted in the changing character of American society and economy and related developments abroad, moving American opinion leaders away from support for individualism and private property rights and toward support for collectivism and more active government involvement in economic affairs. By itself, this tendency would have helped to promote the growth of government. But the secular tendency of ideology was hardly the only aspect of ideological change to affect our political economy in the 20th century. Even more important, in my view, was the succession of national emergencies that struck the country between 1914 and 1945, and to a lesser degree during the post-war era as well. Clearly, the World Wars and the Great Depression had the greatest impact, although the period from the mid-1960s to the mid-1970s also witnessed many significant events. How did these crises contribute to shifting American views about the proper role of government in economic life? In brief, the process worked as follows. First, each crisis gave rise to public clamor that the government do something. In the post-progressive era, no government wished, nor could rulers expect, to prosper politically if they chose to keep their hands off the economy when a problem of overriding public concern had arisen. So, whether to prosecute a war, or to alleviate a depression, or to suppress a great labor upheaval, the government adopted interventionist policies to deal with the crisis. Any government policy entails costs. The greater the costs, the less willing the public is to support the policy. Hence, governments face a hard choice. On the one hand, they cannot just stand by because the public demands that they act. On the other hand, any policy they adopt is subject to the law of demand, which means that in the extreme, the public will reject a government that imposes unbearably large sacrifices on the citizenry. How can the government get off the horns of this dilemma? The short answer is, adopt policies that obscure the costs as much as possible. One way to do so is to avoid policies that entail pecuniary, and therefore easily counted, aggregated, and publicized costs. Instead, adopt command and control policies whose costs tend to be hidden or extremely difficult to compute and aggregate. For example, if an outright gift of public funds is made to farmers, everyone can see how much the government is taking from taxpayers in order to give to farmers. But if the government adopts crop restriction programs, the costs are spread across all those, including foreigners, who purchase the farm products whose supplies have been restricted. Who can say how great the transfer is? Indeed, many people will never appreciate the redistributive aspect of the program, as they would if an explicit farmer benefit tax had been enacted and added, say, as a separate item on the income tax return. Other prominent examples include the conscription of men into the armed forces, the suppression or restriction of certain industries or products during wartime, the establishment of priorities for the supply of selected goods and services, the rationing of consumer goods, and a whole array of price, wage, and rent controls that distort the structure of prices and alter the allocation of resources, benefiting some while placing burdens on others. The common aspect of all such policies is that their costs are more or less hidden, and hence the political reaction to them is muted. When the government adopted cost-obscuring policies during the great national emergencies, officials also undertook massive propaganda efforts to justify their actions. No doubt, many citizens believed what their leaders told them about the virtues of the policies. In addition, during each crisis, the administrators of the controls finessed them to eliminate some of their most objectionable aspects, and people more readily swallowed the medicine when its bitterness was diminished. All the while, people tried to make the best of a bad situation, and many discovered that even a controlled economy offers certain avenues to personal success, either within the government itself or within the favored sectors of the remaining private economy. People adapt. But here is the crux. They adapt not just their actions, but eventually their thinking too. In William Graham Sumner's telling phrase, "It is not possible to experiment with a society and just drop the experiment whenever we choose. The experiment enters into the life of the society and never can be got out again." People who had experienced the abruptly enlarged government programs of the national emergency periods came away from those experiences with an altered view of the benefits and costs, virtues and vices of an expanded government presence in American economic life. Further, in each case, committed collectivists took advantage of the event to hammer home the point that what the government had done, apparently with success, during the crisis, demonstrated the great potential for good that lay in expanded government action, even during normal times. To many people, the argument seemed to make sense. After all, we had won the war. We had got out of the Depression. In retrospect, and with careful study, one can see that people were committing the fallacy of post hoc ergo propter hoc. In many cases, if not in all, the genuine benefits accruing to the nation as a whole, escape from the Depression, defeat of the Nazis, came forth in spite of, not because of, the government's imposition of sweeping controls. But again, people in general didn't reach this conclusion. Rather, they tended to accept the collectivist claims, or more cynically, to appreciate that even if the country at large might suffer, they themselves now had a grip on a personally rewarding piece of the statist program. By the end of World War II, the United States had altered its effective constitution radically from the regime in place at the beginning of the 20th century. Now, virtually any government action, whatever in relation to the economy, could be taken, so long as an electoral majority could be obtained by its initiators. In a political economy so corrupted by interest group politics, an electoral majority was itself something that could be bought, indirectly, if not directly. There remained no fundamental check on the growth of government, nothing to perform the restraining functions that the old Constitution and the dominant limited government ideology had performed in the 19th century. Politicians now could offer to sell virtually any economic policy whatever, no matter how few the gainers and how many the losers. Of course, such conditions were tailor-made to bring forth special interests prepared to buy the policies from the politician suppliers. In the welter of largely contradictory policies, deadweight costs mounted enormously. More and more resources were devoted simply to working for or against economic policies and to circumventing or adapting to the proliferating requirements imposed by government. Not surprisingly, more and more latent interest groups saw the need to organize for political action. By the 1970s, the entire economy had been thoroughly politicized, so that even the most intimate matters, such as babysitting services or nursing homes or the religious calendars of employees, had become subject to government intervention. The growth of government cannot continue forever. An economy totally dominated by government isn't viable. Even the communists now recognize this. Eventually, the government will eat up so much of the private sector that it will destroy the means of its own sustenance. At some point, the balance of political power will swing away from support for bigger government in an effort to revive the dying goose that lays the golden eggs. If such reaction can occur in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, it certainly can occur here. But that glorious day, in my judgment, is not yet in sight. Despite the plethora of burdens laid on the American people, the private economy retains sufficient vitality to limp along at a modest pace, albeit far slower than a truly free economy could progress. And the American people continue to demand, or at least to tolerate, a multitude of government programs promising solutions to almost every conceivable problem. So long as the dominant ideology lends support to collectivist measures and acquiesces in a political system dominated by special interest deals, no far-reaching reform of our political economy is possible. So, as we look into the future of the United States in 1990, as far as the eye can see, we behold only big government and more big government. A Fee Classic, The Basis of Liberty, by Dean Russell. Dr. Russell, a former member of the staff of the Foundation for Economic Education, is a retired economics professor. This article appeared in the Freeman, July 1963. In one of his fables, Aesop said, "A horse and a stag, feeding together in a rich meadow, began fighting over which should have the best grass. The stag, with his sharp horns, got the better of the horse. So the horse asked the help of man. And man agreed, but suggested that his help might be more effective if he were permitted to ride the horse and guide him as he thought best. So the horse permitted man to put a saddle on his back and a bridle on his head. Thus they drove the stag from the meadow. But when the horse asked man to remove the bridle and saddle and set him free, man answered, 'I never before knew what a useful drudge you are. And now that I have found what you are good for, you may rest assured that I will keep you to it.'" The Roman philosopher and poet Horace said of this fable, "This is the case of him who, dreading poverty, parts with that invaluable jewel, liberty. Like a wretch as he is, he will be always subject to a tyrant of some sort or other, and be a slave forever, because his avaricious spirit knew not how to be contented with that moderate competency which he might have possessed independent of all the world." Ever since man learned to write, one of his favorite subjects has been freedom and liberty. And almost always, it has been his own government that he most feared as the destroyer of his liberty. Further, various economic issues, primarily the ownership of property and the control of one's time and labor, have always been listed prominently among the measurements of liberty. Justice Sutherland of our Supreme Court clearly saw this connection when he said, "The individual has three rights, equally sacred from arbitrary interference from government: the right to his life, the right to his liberty, the right to his property. These three rights are so bound together as to be essentially one right. To give a man his life, but to deny him his liberty, is to take from him all that makes his life worth living. To give him his liberty, but to take from him the property which is the fruit and badge of his liberty, is to still leave him a slave." Frederick Bastiat, the French political economist of the last century, phrased the same idea another way. "Life, liberty, and property do not exist because men have made laws. On the contrary, it was the fact that life, liberty, and property existed beforehand that caused men to make laws in the first place." A primary lesson of history is that liberty generally flourishes when goods are privately owned and distributed. I can find no example of real freedom for the people over a significant period of time when the means of production were mostly owned by the government, or by a restricted and self-perpetuating group who controlled the powers of government. In addition, material prosperity for the people in general has surged forward whenever the production and distribution of goods and services have been determined by the automatic processes of competition in a free market. And prosperity has faltered and often failed completely whenever governmental controls over the economic activities of the people have grown onerous. The particular form of government under which the people lived doesn't appear to have made much difference one way or the other. Liberty and prosperity have flourished under democracies and have disappeared under democracies. Liberty and prosperity have flourished under kings and emperors, and have disappeared under kings and emperors. Over the long haul, the extent of liberty and prosperity has always hinged on the degree of private ownership and competition in a free market, and not on how many people voted or didn't vote at a particular time. As Aesop and Horace so clearly pointed out in their pungent comments on this subject, liberty is generally surrendered by the people themselves to their own government in an effort to get more of the material things of life. It has never worked for long. End of The Basis of Liberty by Dean Russell. We hope you have enjoyed this August 1990 edition of The Freeman on Tape. For more information, write to the Foundation for Economic Education, 30 South Broadway, Irvington-on-Hudson, New York, 10533, or call area code 914-591-7230. Civilization consists in teaching men to govern themselves. Benjamin Tucker, Instead of a Book, 1893.